From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's On Story, we're tracing the history of modern film comedies back to a singular movie celebrating its 40th anniversary. Grab your toga and your college sweatshirt as comedy writers reflect on Animal House's lasting influence.
This movie really was the birth of modern comedy. If you look at Caddyshack and Stripes and, you know, Wedding Crashers and The Hangover, like, they all sort of came from Animal House.
We'll also hear from SNL alum and Adam Sandler collaborator Tim Herlihy, who used the National Lampoon movies as a model to write some of the biggest comedies of the 1990s.
I think in a way, The Waterboy was a reaction to The Wedding, like this explosion of id, like literally tackling and killing people, because The Wedding Singer had been so sweet and sentimental, almost syrupy.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. 40 years ago, National Lampoon's Animal House changed American comedies and shaped people's expectations of the college experience. The frat comedy was an instant success when it was released in 1978 and remains one of the most quotable films. Beverly Hills Cop writer Daniel Petrie Jr. and Role Models writer Tim Dowling explored Animal House's lasting legacy at the Austin Film Festival in a conversation moderated by filmmaker Roy Rutmalone. Clips of Animal House courtesy of Universal City Studios, Inc.
I'm a child of the 80s, and so I watched this movie in college, and I kind of feel like it's standard viewing for most people who decide to go to college. It's a very classic comedy, and often I've seen it actually called one of the best comedies ever made as well. So we know it's in the National Film Registry as well, so there's a copy at the Library of Congress. It's that culturally significant. So I was curious upon both of your first viewings, like, kind of how did it strike you the first time you watched this movie?
I, first of all, became a fan right away. I enjoyed the movie, but I also had a sense, you know, as somebody who was interested in being a writer someday, as a guy who was working very low level at the time in the business and had ambitions toward comedy specifically, that I felt I was in the presence of a game changer taking place, that from now on, film comedy is not going to be quite the same as it was, that another sensibility, another generation shift has taken place. And I think that impression has been borne out over time. I don't know if you think so too, Tim, but it really led to so many other things, not necessarily derivative movies, although there were plenty, but a sensibility that really affected film comedy for years to come, and in some respects, permanently.
Yeah, I was going to say that I don't remember the first time that I saw it. I mean, I was too young when it came out to see it in the theater, but I remember watching it on TV, and I loved this movie. But I think in thinking about this, kind of what Dan said is right, is I feel like this movie really was the birth of modern comedy. If you look at Caddyshack and Stripes and, you know, the movie I did, Role Models, definitely we're trying to have the same spirit of this. And, you know, Wedding Crashers and The Hangover, like, they all sort of came from Animal House. And, you know, I think in other ways, too, like, if you look at the comedies that came before, like, it really just launched this sensibility. And, you know, like, Ivan Reitman was one of the producers. This was his first film. And then he went on to do Meatballs and Caddyshack and Stripes and Ghostbusters. And I think his sensibility is very much a part of this. John Landis, who directed it, you know, I mean, he went on to, God, direct, like, everything. And yeah. Blues Brothers. And I think also, too, if you look at it, you know, TV and film were so separate. And like John Belushi being this, I think ushered open like a whole generation of Saturday Night Live stars that then went to movies, because there really wasn't that crossover then. And it just, it had this like fun sort of sensibility that I love 80s movies too. I'm a child of the 80s. And 80s movies are just fun. And I think this sort of like helped kind of like launch that. Like the 70s, generally the movies were kind of darker and bleaker. And like this movie was just a good time. And, you know, I think this movie also created the idea of a comic set piece, which hadn't really existed in movies before.
You know, Dan, you mentioned it's a game changer. I'm kind of curious if we can talk a little bit more about what you think, why you think it's different. You know, there's three writers was credited here, which is Douglas Kenny, Chris Miller, and Harold Ramis, and I think the former two were National Lampoon's writers. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on, because they're basically writing about their experience in college, and they're kind of lampooning that. And I wanted to see if you thought that might have an impact on why maybe this movie is so good, or why it's considered, so many people can watch it throughout generations and just get so much out of it.
Well, I think there was a sense of comedy that came out of the Harvard Lampoon, which led to the National Lampoon, which itself, in as a magazine, advanced comedy in some ways. Maybe advanced is the wrong word, but it used a different sensibility, much more in your face, and adults knowing versus Mad Magazine of the previous generation. And these were based on stories that were short stories, but they were based on, derived from Kenny's experiences as a undergrad at Dartmouth in a frat like Delta House. And those stories I remember reading, they were very funny, but those led into the movie. But if you look at the writing staff of The Simpsons, half those people, I swear, are out of the Harvard Lampoon, you know, school. It was enormously influential in, you know, traced back to that and to the National Lampoon.
So we have the Deltas and the Omegas and Dean Wormer. It's a counterculture kind of underdog story too. And I kind of feel like maybe that's part of why it's got this real kind of classic through line there. So.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was the first of the, it was called the Slobs versus the Snobs. Right. And so you would have, you know, like the Rival Fraternity and like, you know, Dean Wormer, and like, it was basically the idea of the establishment against these sort of like slobs, like the underdogs that were like fighting back. And if you look at like the whole Judd Apatow sort of comedy movement, like all those guys, like, you know, the idea of like, you know, Jonah Hill and Seth Rogen as leading men, like probably wouldn't have existed before something like this. You know, it was sort of the everyman, like the low man on the totem pole, sort of fighting back against the establishment. And that's very much this movie.
The period that the movie takes place in was very well chosen. The movie is a late 70s movie, but it talks about the early 60s, where you very much had the dominant culture be the 50s culture of the very traditional frats, and then the emergence of a counter culture.
Right.
It hadn't fully emerged yet, no hippies,
right,
but suddenly there's this new stuff, pot, is floating around campus. What's that?
Right.
Kids are still wearing ties, but they're putting a toe in that other direction that then became the dominant direction.
Right.
Omega House has very 50s influenced hairstyles on Mandy, and then now we go to Delta House, and it's the introduction to a new world.
What I think this does that's so smart is that there's so many characters in this movie. Like, if you gave them all an introductory scene, like, you would have half the movie already done.
Yeah.
And so it's something, and they do this in TV too, is that by having those two guys, they're our eyes, and they're the eyes of the audience into this world.
That's
so we
right.
get to meet all the Omegas, and we get to see this world, and we're following these guys as, you know, it's like as the audience as well, and introducing, we're meeting all the Omegas, we're about to meet the Deltas. We've met most of the major characters in the movie.
That's
and you
right.
get a total sense for them.
Yeah, and the economy of storytelling, getting so much information just in, not in dialogue particularly, but just in the frame. You know, we see so many things and draw conclusions from it, as well as being scenes that don't feel introductory because they are totally funny in their own right.
Yeah.
I don't know, Larry. I don't think you're trying very hard.
I hate this.
Look, no sweat. My brother Fred was a Delta. That makes me a legacy. They gotta take me. It's like their law. Don't worry. I'll put in a good word for you.
Great. I heard Delta's the worst house on campus.
Excuse me, sir, is this the Delta house?
Sure. Come on in.
You know, some producer told me years ago that you should always have mythic introductions for your main characters. And it's really brief, but like how they introduce Belushi is they come up and he's peeing, but the outside, but the thing is he's got a beer in his hand. And it's just great. And then he like starts peeing on them, and then he's like stumbling up the stairs, and it's like instantly you know who this guy is.
That's right.
And it's a great introduction.
Yeah, I was going to say also along those lines, I think the music's actually also one of those things that's a really interesting thing because they've got a real contrast in Elmer Bernstein's score, and then you're jumping in and you've got Louie Louie, they're playing that right away, and I think it serves as a good contrast along the lines of the generational thing that you're kind of like.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, it got one of the biggest laughs, which I'd forgotten about, but the one guy playing the piano and he's like nodding at him, the thing, and then you go to the other place and like rock and roll music's blaring, like
that's
it's perfect.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Who dumped a whole truckload of fizzies into the swim meet? Who delivered the medical school cadavers to the alumni dinner? Every Halloween, the trees are filled with underwear. Every spring, the toilets explode.
You're talking about Delta, sir.
Of course I'm talking about Delta, you twerp! This year it's going to be different. This year we're going to grab the bull by the balls and kick those punks off campus.
What do you intend to do, sir? Delta's already on probation.
They are?
Yes, sir.
Oh. Then as of this moment, they're on double secret probation.
You know, comedies generally aren't plot driven. And I think they do it in such a fun way here because if you look structurally at Animal House, like in terms of the story, it's like, the fun of this movie is them partying and the set pieces and the different scenes in the world, but that'll get old really fast. So you need something driving the plot. And so this is sort of a great way to do that, which is they're going to get kicked off campus. And we've now met the villain and they do it in a really fun way. He was great. And it's like, he's written in a really fun way. And we set up the stakes of the movie. It's like, these guys are going to get kicked off campus. And we know that the Omegas are also going to try to help get them kicked off campus.
And it introduced the idea of using actors who are not known for comedy.
Yeah.
You know, John Vernon had a very distinguished career on stage and screen. People didn't know that he had the comedic chops as well. And he plays it without winking at the audience, or only very subtly. So many movies make the mistake of thinking, oh, it's a comedy. Everybody has to be funny.
Right.
The bad guys don't have to be funny.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with an exploration of what made the college comedy Animal House so unique in 1978 and why it continues to be relevant to audiences today. When we left off, Beverly Hills Cop writer Daniel Petrie Jr. and Role Models writer Tim Dowling were discussing the film's unconventional casting choices.
They nailed the tone perfectly, is that he's a really good actor. He, you know, feels like a dramatic actor, and he was playing it really straight. Just the dialogue's really funny. And so yes, it works, but you get, he's intimidating, and you get the idea that this guy is an actual threat to these guys.
And that means one more slip up, one more mistake, and this fraternity of yours has had it at Faber.
That was pleasant. Nice of him to stop by, don't you think?
We've got to do something. He's serious this time. I think he knows about the exams.
He's right.
You're right. We got to do something.
Absolutely.
You know what we got to do?
Toga party. We're on double secret probation, whatever that is. We can't afford to have a toga party.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
I think they like the idea, Hoove.
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
We got news for you, pal. They're gonna nail us no matter what we do.
So we might as well have a good time.
Toga, 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 toga.
It's an example of a comic set piece. You know, the Deltas have been warned by now, and their reaction to this warning is toga, toga, you know, and their decision to throw the toga party has consequences, so it is built into the story, but it also just stands on its own.
If you guys see North by Northwest, one of my favorite movies, like Hitchcock used to always say that, you know, no one cares about the plot. And so he was trying to get the plot down to the barest minimum, and that the plot of that movie really is there's that they say that the bad guy is an importer and exporter of secrets, and there's microfilm that's mentioned. But that's basically it. But what you remember is Cary Grant being chased by a plane, and what you remember from Animal House is the toga party. But I really do think that this was the first movie that really made comic set pieces like front and center. Pretty much most studio comedies that come after that, when you think of them, it's when you think of Hangover or American Pie or Stripes, it's like you can always point to the comic set pieces, and really Animal House kind of created that. There's a lot of great bits, like I think it's in the same scene, but I always love the which again fits the theme of the movie, is the like the emo sort of like hippie guy singing song.
And then Belushi goes up. That was
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh wow. And you know, I gave my love a cherry, and then he smashes the thing.
His guitar. Which is,
yeah.
I gave my love a cherry that had no stone. I gave my love a chicken that had no bones. I gave my love a story that had no end. I give.
Sorry.
But it's sort of the theme of the movie, which is the slobs against the snobs and like fighting back against the, it's like that guy shouldn't be at the toga party. Like he shouldn't be doing, it's like it's about, you know, barting it up and anyway, it's a really great scene.
This is ridiculous.
What are we gonna do?
Road trip.
But you can't take the car! Otter Fred wrote the mileage down! He wants it back by Sunday! Please don't take the car! It's very important! He'll get very mad at me! No, you can't! No! No! But Otter, don't you understand? He wants it back! Where'd you go? He wants it back by Sunday!
Fred's gonna kill me! This car is expensive!
We won't tell
anybody that it happened.
Hey,
hear Dickinson girls are fast. Well, what should I say? I mean, how should I handle it?
Just mention modern art, civil rights, or folk music, and you're in like Flynn.
You sure we have dates?
Absolutely. Boom, what's this chick's name again?
This whole sequence is really off the spine of the story. It's an adventure. It's a road trip that they take. But again, it was a central component of the movie, completely in line with everybody's character, but it's kind of exists separately from the spine. The other thing I'll say is Tim Matheson does insincerity, or sincere insincerity, better than anybody I know. It was a little hard sometimes to watch him play the vice president in the early years of The West Wing. Although he's playing it straight, you think that twinkle is there, that he's sending up, You know,
it's always good to surprise the audience and to take sort of unexpected detours. And you can do it in a comedy. I mean, really, the sequence, like, you could cut this out of the movie, and the movie still exists and it works because it doesn't affect anything else. But it's so much fun, and it's also very much in character for Tim Matheson. We could hate these guys because they're taking advantage of a girl's death, but they play it really well, and everyone, you know, I mean, he is sincerely insincere, but it fits in his character, and also its placement in the movie. At this point, we like these guys. If it happened a little bit earlier, it might not have worked as well, because I'm like, oh, that guy's such a But it just, it's so much fun, because, like, who would have ever thought of a scene in this? You're like, oh, it's a college movie, you know, it's about a bunch of attorneys, and they're partying. It's like, well, we take like a 20-minute or 15-minute sequence where they go to a rival college and they read the obituary, and then they go and pretend to be the boyfriend of a dead girl and then take her and her friends out on a date.
And sometimes the best things are the little throwaway, like, she was making me a pot. Yeah. You know? Every time I see that, I howl. I just can't help it. She was making me a pot.
What's going on?
They confiscated everything, even the stuff we didn't steal.
They took the bar! The whole bar!
Otter, this is ridiculous.
What are we gonna do?
Road trip.
The placement of the film, or the placement of that sequence in the film, is really great. What kind of prompts it is they're kind of being kicked out of their house, right? In the kind of moment of crisis, and it's great. And it's like, what's your response to it? Road trip. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
You take that great left turn.
Their first response is toga party.
Right.
Then they escalate with road trip.
Right.
That's a great speech. A terrific moment. Very funny. But it also is like a terrific structural moment that illustrates what Stephen Cannell used to refer to as the end of the second act, as the destruction of the protagonist's plan. They reach their low point just prior to the entrance of Matheson. And then in the same scene, they launch, we don't know what it is yet, but they launch into the third act. They go from the low point, and now it's going to be one accelerating comic action sequence that takes us from here to the climax of the movie, with maybe one minor side turn, which is Larry and the girl.
Like, you have to have a big, you know, act three set piece. Like, I think all great comedies do, you know, and like, there's not a natural one. It's like, okay, what are they going to throw another party? Like, we've already seen that a couple times. It's like, we have them kicked out, and it's like, no, they're going to destroy the town and like do this thing in the parade. And it's really fun, but it feels right for this movie. Like, they're going to go all out, and it's a really sort of fun way to end this film. So we have the guys hit the low point, and then they come up with a plan in the same scene. And like the Dean Wormer scene, they make it really fun. Like, you have Belushi, who's probably the dumbest character in the movie, get up and give the rallying speech, and it's done in a really fun way.
Looks like I missed something.
Yeah, you did. We're all officially kicked out of school. Wormer just got our grades.
It kicked us out of school? Huh. That makes sense.
Hey! What's this lying around?
Well, what the hell is supposed to do, you moron?
War's over, man. Wormer dropped the big one.
What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? No!
Germans? Forget it, he's rolling.
And it ain't over now. Because when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Who's with me? Let's go. Come on.
So, awesome sequence, and technically kind of innovative because it not only was the climax, but as the climax was of the movie is taking place, you're simultaneously with those freeze frames seeing the epilogue. You know, people want to know what would happen to those characters, and you need a button on the movie, and that provided.
Yeah, the Belushi's a senator is great because they all feel, most of them feel about right for them, and and then like that's a great sort of final sort of gag.
Yeah, and they kind of wrap up kind of everybody's kind of nemesis. They kind of have their little face-offs, and they kind of tie all that kind of stuff.
And they get their comeuppance too, like exactly. Dean Wormer, you know, the guy's trying to strangle him. It's like, you know, Niedermeyer gets taken away in the thing, and then he gets killed in Vietnam. Exactly.
Landis loves mayhem. And he is great at it, at staging it. The car crashes, in particular. Look at Blues Brothers, which is, you know, this movie, although it was made by a studio, did have kind of an indie sensibility. It was done away from Hollywood, I think University of Washington, and at a very tight budget for the time. And how they did that huge downtown sequence with the riot, that must have been challenging.
Yeah, I don't know, but you always hear those stories back in the day. I have a feeling that Universal probably wasn't thinking much about this movie. And it probably was a low budget, like sort of like side thing. And then we're probably very surprised when this became a hit. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of like American Graffiti, which was also Universal at that time. Universal hated the movie so much they didn't want to release it. Because they're like, who's going to go see this movie? But like contractually, I think he had it in his contract. They had to test the movie someplace, or it had to play in like one theater, and then it like sold out and became this huge phenomenon. It made both Animal House and American Graffiti made, I think, over $100 million. They were like in, like nowadays these would be like $300 million grossing movies, which is unheard of for a comedy.
You've been listening to Turner and Hooch writer Daniel Petrie Jr. and Role Models writer Tim Dowling on the influence Animal House and the National Lampoon had on modern film comedies. Animal House co-writers Harold Ramis and Doug Kenny were a direct influence on the collaboration between Tim Herlihy and Adam Sandler. In the 1990s, Herlihy co-wrote a string of successful films that launched Sandler into an unlikely leading man. Some of his writing credits include Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, and The Wedding Singer. He conceived of most of these films while writing at Saturday Night Live. I spoke with Tim Herlihy at the Austin Film Festival in 2016. Clips of Billy Madison, courtesy of Universal City Studios, Inc.
Oh, back to school, to prove to Dad that I'm not a fool. I got my lunch packed up, my boots tied tight. I hope I don't get in a fight. Oh, back to school, back to school, back to school. Well, here goes nothing.
Okay, y'all. Tim Herlihy, right here. So I think you all know him as Adam Sandler's muse. And also probably from Saturday Night Live. So I told you yesterday I'd gone to the internet to Google and find information and then later find out it's totally incorrect. But the information I found out wasn't totally incorrect. In fact, you did get a perfect score on your LSAT, and that got you a gig on Saturday Night Live, right?
It's sort of, no, had nothing to do.
Okay, but you did have a perfect score in your LSAT, and you went to law school. And then that somehow led you to Saturday Night Live. Can you talk about how that process went?
Well, I was Adam Sandler's college roommate at NYU. We were freshman year roommates, and I was an accounting major. He was a drama student. He actually went to the Lee Strasberg Institute. And we were friends, and he did his thing, and I did mine. And sophomore year, he decided he wanted to do stand-up. So a bunch of us, you know, friends of Adam's, helped him out with jokes and wrote up some jokes. And I lived in Poughkeepsie at the time, or my parents lived in Poughkeepsie. That's where I grew up, and take a train along the Hudson River. And I would write jokes, you know, just as a goof. You know, just I had no aspirations to write any. I'd never written anything in my life. And then Adam told my jokes on stage, and they got laughs. And I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. So it kind of developed from there. And by junior year, he was doing more road gigs. I ended up sort of writing a lot of his material. And he would pay me 10% of his earnings, which I probably should have stuck with that. And would have worked out. But I get my $350. But then my senior year, he was back in Manhattan doing the marquee clubs. And he went off to L.A. after graduation. And I stayed in New York and worked as an accountant at Mobil Oil. And then went to law school. And he worked on his career out in Los Angeles. And then he came back to SNL and started asking for help with sketches. He was actually hired as a writer. And so I helped him out again. It was very gratifying and fun, and took me about, you know, an hour a week of doing this stuff, and, you know, being able to be part of, you know, Opera Man and Canteen Boy and Cajun Man, and it was just kind of fun. So summer 93, I was actually working as a lawyer on Wall Street, and I took some time off. I got 4 weeks vacation. Lawyers get 4 weeks off. So I took 2 weeks, and I went to LA where Adam was shooting a movie called Airheads. And he said, let's write a movie. So I said, I don't know how to write a movie. So we got two scripts, the script for Airheads and the script for a movie called PCU. And we started working on the movie and the trailer and trying up with ideas. And we kind of invented our own process. You know, no idea of first act, second act, third act, just complete two idiots who think they can write a movie. And then I went back and I wrote it at the law firm while he remained in LA. And it was for Lorne Michaels, who had asked for it. And we showed it to Lorne, and he summoned me to a meeting at the after party for the Nicole Kidman show. So I was like just some lawyer sitting there, and there's Tom Cruise, and there's Nicole Kidman. And he told me he didn't like it. And I was like, okay, kind of put a pall on the evening. But that was kind of the end of my showbiz dream at that point. I had written sketches to be considered as a writer for Saturday Night Live, but the head writer had never even read them. So I gave up. And I plowed into the law and never thought that anything was going to happen. But then Adam said, oh, somebody at Universal is interested in the script, Billy Madison. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. It so happened that in March of 1994, we sold Billy Madison to Universal, and they asked me to do a two-week tryout at SNL. So I don't know why I did this. I lied to the law firm. I had the other 2 weeks of vacation, and I said I was going to the Bahamas. And I just went up to 30 Rock and worked for 2 weeks on the show. And I got three sketches on in 2 weeks, which was pretty good. And I got hired. And so because I was able to have SNL and selling the script, I was able to, like, you know, be able to face my parents and say I had given up being a lawyer and wanted to be in show business. And that summer we shot Billy Madison, and then that fall I started full-time at Saturday Night Live.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We're back with former SNL writer and Adam Sandler collaborator Tim Herlihy. When we left off, the Waterboy and Grown Ups co-writer was discussing writing Billy Madison while working his day job as a Wall Street attorney. Clips of Saturday Night Live, courtesy of National Broadcasting Company, Inc. Clips of The Wedding Singer, courtesy of New Line Productions, Inc. Clips of The Waterboy, courtesy of Touchstone Pictures, and ADO Disney Enterprises, Inc.
So did you go back after that last 2 weeks from the Bahamas? Did you go with the tan, first of all, and then did you to just
quit? No tan, and nobody commented, but I had to go back and I had to give 4 weeks notice. Again, just like the 4 weeks vacation, you got to give 4 weeks notice. And then I said, I got another job. And they're like, oh, really, what you doing? I'm like, I'm working at Saturday Night Live. And nobody cared. It was like, I thought it'd be like, oh my God, and nobody cared. It was like, everybody on Wall Street is so into Wall Street. They just think that, you know, when you're doing something, no matter what, if you get elected president, you're like, oh, well, whatever.
So how did it work to end up becoming head writer on the show? I mean,
after my first full year, which was 94, 95, they fired virtually everybody. Adam left, Farley left. Phil Hartman had left the year before, and the show had really suffered. It was the year that Janine Garofalo was on and Chris Elliott, but it was considered a major artistic failure. They were talking about canceling the show, the rumors, so they kind of forced Lauren to clean house. So I instantly went from being one of the most junior people to one of the most senior people because I had a year more than everybody else. So a year later, I was head writer.
I'd love it if you'd talk about some of the sketches that you did and where the ideas came from, because that's such an idea machine. And I think, you know, when you sit down to write a screenplay or you're going to write a spec script or something, you're thinking in one vein, you know, and now you've written this script for Billy Madison, but now you're having to come up with new ideas all the time, and those ideas are... It seems like it's pretty heady competition.
So, yeah, the first year I worked a lot with Adam, and we did, you know, the Canteen Boys, and my favorite ones from that was Captain Jim and Pedro. It's about Tim Meadows and him play guys who are marooned on a desert island, and it slowly becomes, you know, but now they're back, and the first one he's interviewing for a job at Foot Locker, and the second one they're going on a date, a double date, and it just becomes apparent that they're both insane. And I did some kind of absurd stuff with Will Ferrell that was pretty funny. There was a guy, I'm sure nobody remembers this guy, a guy named Jack Perkins, who had a very distinctive voice. He was a newscaster, and he wasn't even famous back then, but Daryl Hammond did the best impression of him. And he used to host this show called Biography.
Welcome to Biography. I'm Jack Perkins. Unless you've been in a cave for the last week, you've heard of a young man named Tiger Woods. He won the Masters Golf Tournament on Sunday, and since then, the entire nation has been abuzz about this extraordinary young man. I have quite a buzz myself right now.
And then, yeah, I did a lot of the political stuff during the 96 election, and, you know, and I really give all the credit for that to Norm's Bob Dole impression and Daryl's Bill Clinton impression. And then, yeah, towards the end of my tenure, Tracy had this character, Brian Fellow, and kind of needed a place to put it, and just animal talk show, the easiest thing in the world, so.
Well, didn't your wife know somebody, isn't that right?
My wife's neighbor was Canteen Boy. But that was Adam's, her neighbor in Queens, New York was a kid who always had a canteen on, and that's how Canteen Boy was born. We did a sketch with Alec Baldwin where he played a scoutmaster who molested Canteen Boy, and they weren't in love with that at NBC. I think they got 2,000 complaints. And so next time Alec hosted, I was there, was that first year, and I wrote Canteen Boy and Scoutmaster Armstrong's Christmas Reunion, and he plays Santa Claus, and Canteen Boy gets on his lap. And after the read-through, everybody retires to the Lauren's, not everybody, but Lauren and the host and the head writers, and at that time I was a very junior writer, but Lauren brought me in because he wanted to say, Tim, do you think you can navigate this? And then the censor on the show is very ineffectual and very easy to fool. And he actually barged into Lauren's office and went, no way, no way, and marched out. But yeah, that was the Canteen Boy would never rear his ugly head on network television again.
And what was that work difference like when you were doing Saturday Night Live? Were you just working all the time when you were doing SNL?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't so super conscious, but I couldn't work like that now. There's an exhaustion factor at Saturday Night Live. The off week is like you're off. You're laying in bed till 2 in the afternoon and getting a bagel and going back to bed. I mean, you're just wiped. And I would be writing these movies, you know, and I don't know where I got
the energy to do it.
But you were on the show for...
like 5.5 years, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a long time there, isn't it, at Saturday Night Live?
It's about average, I'd say. I think people have been staying there longer. I think that crew that came in the year after me, like Steve Higgins and Adam McKay and even and Paul Appel and even some of the actor, Will Ferrell, and they stayed there a long time, but before that there was much more turnover, behind the scenes and acting.
Then Billy Madison, so you're, at this point you're having a very successful time.
The entire time at Saturday Night Live, I'm churning out movies. I'm in the summer, I did that first year of SNL, which was Adam's last year, my first full year, I was writing Happy Gilmore. And then we shot it that summer, right after Adam got fired. And then I went back to SNL and did The Wedding Singer. I wrote The Wedding Singer while he was, you know, and this was like a cycle that went on next year with The Waterboy and the next year with Big Daddy.
Each one of those, how did you, you work on Billy Madison, that works. Then that one's taking off, and you're already doing another one, and the other one is, of course, Happy Gilmore. So how was that process working with the two of you coming up with ideas and writing? What was your role? What was his role? How do you trade off?
Yeah, well, Happy Gilmore was easier because he was still in New York, and we could actually get together, and some of it we wrote in the office, some we wrote at his place, some we wrote at my place, but we actually were in a room. Wedding Singer became harder because we were on different coasts, and we basically would get together or talk on the phone or whatever. We had spent time during the summer kind of hashing things out, and then I would write 5 pages, 8 pages, 10 pages, and then fax them to Adam, and then he would call me and we'd go over them and we just do this process. But I mean, it could get tense at that one because, you know, he had just been fired from Saturday Night Live. He was not thrilled with the folks at Saturday Night Live. I had gone back, you know, there were weeks I could not work on The Wedding Singer because I was doing Saturday Night Live. Adam was very responsive to when I faxed the pages, he would read them right away and give me good thoughts, and it was able to, I think it's the delay, when you're working with somebody on another coast or collaborating with somebody who's not in the room, it's the delay that kills you. It's the, you know, oh, I'll get to it tomorrow. That's the thing that takes all the time. If someone's willing to really instantly give you feedback, then it works.
It just seems like the ideas from the two of you would be, there'd be a lot of them. How would you know which ones you were going to follow into an actual script?
We reached a point with The Wedding Singer where we had the whole first half, we didn't have the second half. And Adam wanted me to take 2 weeks off from SNL and just go out and intensively work. And I couldn't do it. And the studio was getting antsy too. So they fired me and they brought in Carrie Fisher. She was the premier script doctor, especially for romantic comedies at that time. You know, and when we got the script back, you know, it felt like, what did this crazy lady do to our script? But she solved the second act, where he goes over to her house and sees her in the window and she's trying on the dress and thinks he's lost her forever. And then she goes over to his house and meets Linda, his ex-fiancée, and she thinks they've gotten back together, and she goes off to Vegas. But that's a classic old Hollywood 40s romantic comedy ending, which, you know, I didn't watch any movies from the 40s and neither did Sandler, but, you know, Carrie, whose mother was in half of those movies, solved that and enabled things to go forward.
So I'm a big fan of The Wedding Singer. So, I think one of the reasons is it's got a lot of sentimentality in it, comparatively. Did you keep a lot of what Carrie Fisher did, or did you keep that?
What ended up happening is I had a long break coming from SNL, so I went out there for 2 weeks, and we sat around Adam's dining room table with the director and Jack Arpuda, the producer, and really sat there around a dining room table with pages flying everywhere, and rewrote it. Really tore it apart and really rewrote it almost from scratch, but still keeping that second act and keeping what had been most of the first act, just changing a lot of stuff back, obviously, making it more our style of comedy. During a break, we came up with the idea for The Waterboy. Uh-huh. Producer came over, they got an idea about a football player. Like, okay, I'll go sell it. And they went off. And and so that was a productive 2 weeks. But yeah, you say it's sentimental. You know, Adam was very, we kind of wrote it that way. And during the filming of it, Adam, you know, honored that, but he was very nervous. He's like, I'm being too sappy. I'm being a drip. And I think in a way, The Waterboy was a reaction to The Wedding, like this explosion of id, like literally tackling and killing people, because The Wedding Singer had been so sweet and sentimental, almost syrupy. But you know, Drew made it work. I mean, Drew really, you know, at that time, Drew was known as kind of a wild child and, you know, and been at rehab in 13 and was not considered, you know, romantic comedy gold. But she is an actress. She could win Oscar after Oscar. She is so good. And their chemistry really made that work.
Well, were you thinking about her when you were writing it, or was that all after?
No, Adam said, how about Drew Barrymore? Which would now be saying, like, how about Kim Kardashian? And I'm like, no, you know, Drew Barrymore, no. But it worked.
So the one that, the moment in there, I think that still, first time I saw it, I thought, oh my God, not, and then the next time I watched the movie, I thought, oh, that's actually really great, is Billy Idol. And what were you guys doing that brought that idea to the table?
You know, just the idea of flying first class and this guy, if he was forced to buy a first class ticket, and what sort of misadventures you would come happen to you in first class, and like getting the towel and not knowing what to do with it and running into a celebrity. And I think Billy Idol was our first thought. I mean, because it was Billy Idol. And again, it's like the luck of like Bob Barker and Happy Gilmore. It's like you stumble onto this and you don't know if it's a crazy person or, and it's Billy Idol is awesome, awesome actor, awesome guy. Completely game for everything. You know, just the looks he gave and, you know, when the lady asked what the Mile High Club is and he just, you know, it's hard to get a laugh with just an eyebrow, but he did. And yeah, and he came in and it was fantastic.
And Linda answers the door wearing nothing but my Van Halen t-shirt.
No way.
I don't know what to do. She's getting married and he's gonna ruin her life.
Yeah, Glenn doesn't deserve her. All he cares about are possessions. Fancy cars, CD players. Even women are possessions to him.
Yeah. See, Billy Idol gets it. I don't know why she doesn't get it.
Oh, I hope you find her.
So then you said Waterboy. Let's talk about that, too, because I think one of the cool things that you all do is bring in really interesting secondary characters.
Oh, Henry Winkler, and, yeah.
Yeah, Henry Winkler.
that was the late Gene Wilder who we wrote that for, and we went to Gene's house in Stanford and talked to him and tried to get him there. I mean, we had written it for, we were huge Mel Brooks fans, and what a sweet guy, what a wonderful, his wife was very nice, and, you know, a bunch of stupid kids came to his house, and he fed us, and talked to us about the script, and just, we could never get him comfortable, but that beat in there where Coach Klein loses his mind again, and he's on the phone, and the phone's not connected, and we pan down, and he's got a high heel on, that was Gene Wilder's joke. That was his... You know, that was something that he said, and we said, yeah, we're going to put that in the movie.
But were you envisioning Kathy Bates in there? I mean, that was, to me, a brilliant marrying of characters. She couldn't have, I can't imagine now,
yes,
who else you might have actually put in there who could have done any better than Kathy Bates against that character.
I know, yeah, and I look back now and just the balls of casting, you know, like even offering it to Kathy Bates, you know, and her saying, yeah, I mean, I think later on we found out her niece, you know, said, oh, it was a big Adam Sandler fan, big Happy Gilmore fan, and she did it. But she is the best actress, best actor I've ever worked with.
Yeah, but I hadn't really thought about her in a comedy way that way until
now. But I mean, just, that's the thing. I don't think she realized she was in a comedy either. She just was like, she was Mama Boucher. She was this backwoods, you know. And it comes through, if you watch that, the fierce love she has for her son. I mean, she obviously smothered her son with... you know, with love and has, you know, kind of retarded his growth as a human being, but you really feel like that's a loving mother, Kathy Bates.
Let's talk about Bobby playing football.
I don't like it, Mr. Coach Klein. I don't like it one bit. You see, my boy is too delicate to be playing foosball and whatever you call it with them gargantuans.
I don't think you understand, Mrs. Boucher.
No, you don't understand me, Mr. Coach Klein. My boy is all I got left.
So anger management was kind of a big departure, though, tonally, for you from the prior films, wasn't it?
We kind of couldn't believe Nicholson was doing it. Adam was originally supposed to play the doctor in it, and then Rob Schneider was going to play Adam's role in it. And then he said, what if we reversed it? What if I played the main guy, and then we got like a guy like Jack Nicholson to play the shrink? And I was like, well, if you got Jack Nicholson to do it, but a guy like Jack Nicholson, I don't think, you know, Bruce Dern, I mean, it just doesn't have the same, but we got Jack Nicholson to do it. So there was a sense, we weren't sure that Jack knew we were making a comedy. We do these tests. My favorite part of the process is the test screenings, because, I mean, it's nerve-wracking as hell, but like you see the movie in front of a crowd for the first time, and it's like an unveiling, it's like opening night on Broadway. But, you know, obviously Adam is completely, you want to avoid Adam those nights because he is, you know, laser focused. And, you know, if it doesn't go well, I'm like, well, oops, you know, we'll get him next time. I mean, I'm a little more heartbroken than that, but like, Adam has not only wrote the thing with me, but been there every day, you know, 70 hours a week filming it, and then sat in the editing room for week after week after week. So, you know, he's bereft if it's not, you know, doesn't go well. So the first test screening for Anger Management was particularly nerve-wracking because Jack was coming, and we like, I don't know if Jack knows that this is like an Adam Sandler movie with the, you know, and I think he thinks he's in, you know, some kind of other movie. So I was like, I'm gonna be way in the back. I don't want to be near any. I just, you know, I can just see, you know, nothing but trouble. So I wait till the movie actually starts, and I walk in. There's an empty row. And I walk in and I go, they say, please go all the way to the end, all the way to the end. So I go all the way and get right up and there's someone sitting there and I walk, and it's Sandler. Huh. Like, hey buddy, and I'm like, oh God. And then somebody sits down next to me, it's Nicholson. I'm like, oh shit. I'm between Sandler and Nicholson in the first screening of Anger Management. I'm just sitting there and thank God it went well, but it was definitely nerve-wracking. I was definitely like, not with the armrest with Nicholson. Nicholson got full armrest.
Well, it's definitely more serious and dramatic in places than a lot of the other.
Yeah, well, Pete Seeger was a director, and he brought a certain sensibility. You know, he had directed Tommy Boy, and I guess that's sort of silly, but like he's definitely a grown-up filmmaker, and you know, versed in the classics. And he, you know, and it was sort of a sweeping story. And because Jack was in it, we got people like John C. Reilly and you know Woody Harrelson to do smaller parts, and just felt like grown-up time a little bit.
So, I mean, how does your test screening process work? And you test it after you're completely done, or?
Well, yeah, the first, you know, we'll do two or three test screenings. You know, it's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, I'll argue with Sandler. I'll say, please just put this in the script. Please, you know, do this. I know you don't like it, but please, I swear to God, it's going to work. And then, you know, the day they're shooting it and they're like, you know, running late. And I'm like, no, please do it this way. Just please, it'll be fine. Just humor me. Just do it this way. If you go to the test screen, it doesn't work, it's like, all right, cut it. You know, there's nothing. But I do think, especially with these Netflix things, it lends itself to big ha-ha moments over things that people remember. You know, people remember, like Caddyshack, which is one of our favorite movies. If you were sitting in the theater, the thing that probably got the biggest response was the baby Ruth floating in the pool, because it was a big, gross joke. But people don't, when people talk about Caddyshack, they talk about the things that Chevy said or Bill Murray said or, you know, the gopher and, you know, the little subtle, you know, Cinderella story, that sort of thing. And I think sometimes you can make that argument with different movies that, you know, these big whammo moments, which God bless them, I want them, but like there's worthwhile, it's worth keeping some things in that don't get big, huge responses, but maybe in 10 years they'll be the thing that people remember. There was some stuff cut out of Grown Ups with Steve Buscemi's character as the driving instructor. I thought was the funniest thing in the movie. Nobody laughed, but I liked it. But, you know, you're like, well, nobody laughed, so you know, it's hard to make the argument.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Editing help from Jamal Knox and Randy Reynolds. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistants, KUT 90.5 in Austin, and the Sound Lab Studios in Austin, Texas. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.